Mark was still a teenager when he joined Prince's band to play bass. A key member of Prince and the Revolution, an early gig saw him supporting the Rolling Stones, before going on to be part of Prince's 1999 Purple Rain and Parade tours. He left the Purple Kingdom in the mid-1980s for a solo career with Motown Records, before later going back to what he described as a normal life. And Mark is also known for his work with the group Maserati and still tours with the Revolution to this day. Last year, he documented his formative years in the book Inside the Purple Kingdom. Mark, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The Purple Rain album, large chunks of it were actually live takes of songs that were performed in a club in Minneapolis called First Avenue in 1983. That performance, understandably, given that Purple Rain became such a cultural phenomenon, has taken on a kind of myth and legend. You rehearsed a massive amount of material, and you were often thrown in at the deep end. I mean, what are your memories, both leading up to that concert and the actual night itself?
Prince was always recording. We had recording trucks that followed us around. Every day at soundcheck, we would play. I played Purple Rain so much, I could be sleeping and play it. I could go in the lunchroom and make a sandwich and be playing it. You know, we played it so much that it was second nature to us, you know. We could be playing a game of chess while playing that song, you know. And he would constantly record because you never knew where the magic was going to come from. So what Prince was notorious for doing is constantly recording. And this keyboard part might have come from a whole different recording from a different time. Or this bass part might have come from a different recording from a different time, because it's all multi-tracking and you can fly, chop, cut, splice, do whatever you want with it, manipulate it once you have it. And a lot of times he would go into the studio and redo a lot of parts. So I think First Avenue was definitely the trial to get the crowd's response on this new music. And I definitely think First Avenue was the trial to expose the Prince world to Wendy, the new member of the band, to see how they were going to take her. And they loved her. Like I said, girl power, man. Her and Lisa came, man, they just became like an item on that tour, and that, you know, that just that whole concept was a marketing genius. It was excellent the way he took that whole Wendy and Lisa thing and branded it. So, I think First Avenue was just the testing ground to see how it was going to work and what needed improvement versus what doesn't need improvement. Because you can, if you listen to even the solos and even some of the breakdowns, it was different in the First Avenue version in comparison to the album. They're not the same. So I know that's what a lot of journalists and a lot of people want to believe, but it's just not true. It was the foundation, definitely. But that music comes from a lot of different recordings. I'm gonna get a lot of heat for that.
I watched a bit of the live in 1985 concert. I think it was one of the official releases from the Purple Rain tour. And it's really striking how hard the band works, because you're all dancing and you're dancing in unison. And you're doing all this incredible stuff, you know, like you're all moving in motion to Let's Go Crazy. And I forget which song it was, Mark, but there's this incredible thing where you sort of dance and you almost like pop your bass. You do this thing with your bass, like you flick it around your neck or something. It's hard for me to describe, but if people have seen the concert, they'll know what I'm talking about. You know, I didn't realize that it's only recently when I was reading up about you and discovering more that you actually had some input into the choreography for those kinds of shows, and that, you know, Prince would sometimes sort of ask your opinion on such things. And just share sort of a brief reflection on that, because I think that's quite interesting.
I will set another record straight. I did all the choreography for Prince and the Revolution, period. I never choreographed Prince, you know, of course, you know, who can choreograph Prince? But Prince liked the way I danced and played. And so he asked me from the point where the revolution really started in 83, 84, when Dez left and Wendy came on, he asked me specifically to choreograph this band. And he said he wanted everybody moving. And so I would create these dance steps really simple. At first, they were very difficult and, you know, they couldn't catch on. So I had to create movement that was really simple, that from an audience perspective, it would look really cool and uniform. And then Prince would yay or nay it. You know, he would come in and be like, you know, 90% of the times he was like, oh, that's dope. That's dope. Okay. Okay. Show me how you do that. Show me what we're doing. And then I would teach it to him, and then he would take it to a whole nother level. You know, come on, Prince, you know, he always got to be on top. So he would take it to a whole nother level, and it looked so awesome from the audience perspective. And then he would have Roy Bennett, the lighting director, choreograph the lighting according to the movement. So everything was choreographed in our show. When you come to see us, everything was choreographed, all the way down to a very light spinning or something, you know. And contrary to a lot of belief, no, Prince did not choreograph his band. Brown Mark did. And Prince would choreograph Prince and fall into suit with what the band was doing. And that's what made it so powerful. Again, it was a work of unity. You know, it was a collaboration. You know, my style with his style. And that's what made that stuff work. And even a lot of stuff, I remember he used to give a lot of stuff to the Time. Like, I would be doing a dance step, you know, and next thing you know, I go to Time's rehearsal. I was like, you just took that, you know, and he'd have the Time stepping, you know. So that concept came from me early on when I got in the band.
I guess the Purple Rain tour was your Beatlemania moment. Are there any sort of experiences, or is there one moment around the Purple Rain tour you think that sums up the whole craziness of that experience of just packed out stadiums? The group was selling multi-platinum albums. You had a movie out. What are the things that, what, you know, when you reflect on it, you think that really sums that whole craziness up?
That was a weird time period. I think it was more the movie and the premieres, the after parties. And, you know, that's where you really saw the craziness. But when it came to actually the concert itself, it was the pinnacle. We had Wendy now. It was a whole different element. And the audience reaction was phenomenal because for most of the people in the audience, this was the first time that they'd ever seen Prince. See, from the 1999 album, I would say Little Red Corvette moving forward, that was a whole new audience. That was a whole new audience from the audience we were used to. And so when Wendy came on, that's all they knew. A lot of people didn't know who Dez was from that point on because Wendy kind of filled in that slot. And it was girl power, you know. It's like, whoa, you know, there's a girl in the band dressing sexy and she getting down, you know. So, you know, the whole concept shift, and then Prince started paying more attention to the female element. And so everything started to change as far as our live performance and even what it looked like. So as far as the craziness and, you know, that pinnacle of success, I saw it more in the movie frenzy than I did in the concerts, you know, the tour. And, you know, we only went out on the road, you know, less than 6 months. I mean, he pulled it off. He was bored. We had been working on this album for 3 years. He was done. And he pulled that whole tour. And I was like, wait a minute, this is a world tour. We could go around the world and some with this right here. And he was bored. He was like, no. We're going to do something bigger and better. And he had this whole Under the Cherry Moon thing. And he was already working on this Beatles thing, you know, around the world in a day and all this craziness. And had us in, you know, dressing up like the Beatles. He actually had me in wardrobe trying to fit me in a, what do they call it? The waistless hip huggers. Hip huggers. Can you, I'm a dude. He had me in hip huggers. And they were making hip huggers for me, you know, but, you know, my butt was too big. I ripped right out of the things, you know. I was like, no, this ain't working, bro. Yeah, man, and in the front, it the cut was so low, you know, you could see my pubic hairs. I was like, no, man, I can't wear this. And then they had big bell bottoms. He said, no, you just put a chain around your waist and it'll be sexy. And I was like, look, man, you do that. Let me put some real pants on. So, you know, we had wardrobe fights, all kind. It, man, everything was changing. He was on to a whole nother trip.
Absolutely. And you also, I think in the early 80s, people who've read up about Prince and just followed his career saw that he was very interested in writing music for other groups. So the Time were a well-known rival from back in the Minneapolis days. We had Vanity 6, Apollonia 6, The Family, obviously working with you guys in the Revolution. And I know that you worked and were a founder member of the group Maserati.
I had Maserati. I had Giorgio Alentini. I worked with the Troupe. I had a whole bunch of bands that I was trying to form. And to your observation there about Prince and all the different bands, it's the only way to get it out your head. All that music, you got to get it out. And especially when you start dabbling in different genres, it's like, I just put together a group. Just put together a band. They were called producer bands back then. And that's what we would do. We would put together producer bands. They didn't really have a group, but we'd make it look like a group. It was really us doing all the music. I you know, I play drums like Prince. I play keyboards, guitar, bass. You know, and so we would do producer bands. We'd do all the music and just put faces in front of it and then sell it to the record label. That's how it was done. And it's a way to get all of that out of your head so that you can move forward with what you want to do. And so that's what Prince did with The Time. That was his funk side. He knew he didn't want to go funky. He wanted to go rock, pop rock. So let me create The Time, and that's my funk. You know, let me create Vanity 6 and all these sexy songs that won't work for me, I'm going to put on them, you know. And that's what he would do. That's where all these groups came from. The Family, then he started producing people, you know, like the Bangles and all kinds of folks, you know.
You mentioned The Time there, and you went on tour with Prince and The Time. You know, again, I think the perception of Prince publicly is that he was a pretty clean living guy. But you mention in your book that there was a moment where you were very, very young, stardom was thrust upon you, and I just wondered if some of the guys in the band either drank or took drugs, or how did the pressure kind of manifest itself? I know that you kind of had a little bit of a moment with that, the pressure of just so much success so young.
I learned at a very young age that too much is not good. And it made me understand, especially rich kids, a lot of your rich Hollywood kids, kids that come up in movies, kids that come up with that fame and stardom. I really realized the struggle because I was only 19 years old when I joined the band, and it was just in my face. By the time I was 21, 22, I was dealing with, you know, $1 million bank accounts and, fancy cars and the whole shot, not from Prince, from my own hustle. I learned how to, you know, really dig into the industry and find the pockets that made the money. But what came with that is a lot of just a lot of chaos, absolute chaos, because you when you're young, your mind is not ready for that kind of management of affairs. And so when you have groupies and you have fans and you have managers and business people, executives all coming at you from different angles, wow, You know, you realize that you got some power. Yeah, you know, there was one point where I was like, I could go into a restaurant and I could control the narrative. I remember once, to give you an example, Timberwolves were frequented a restaurant I frequented. And I'll never forget when all the players came in this specific time, they were at my table. I had my own booth in the back because I was a regular and it was my booth. They would move people from my booth when I showed up. Okay. That's the power of celebrity. See, the Timberwolves, some of the players were sitting there. I walk in and they says, "Oh, Mr. Brown, okay, hold on a second." And they went and they moved them. They moved them out of my table and resat them. And then so when I came in to sit down, they came over and shook my hand and stuff. They said, we were like, who's coming in here that we're getting moved from the table? We're the Timberwolves, you know, and we're getting moved from our table. We were like, who the heck is this walking up in here? And then they saw it was me. And so it's insight in the world of celebrity where you really start to hold a lot of power, and you can abuse it or you can use it, you know, to the benefit of others. You know, and I think with Prince and the Revolution, some of the other guys can't handle that as well as some of the others, you know. And then you start drinking, you start doing dope, you know, cocaine, some of the other things that started showing up on the tour. I knew about them only because of my position with security. They were most of my friends. Most of the security I grew up with. See, I got them hired. And so I knew all the inside stuff. I knew all the junk that was going on in the background. There was a lot of drugs floating around, a lot of drugs. Fortunately, I never got into the drugs, but I really got into, you know, I started drinking a lot. I had to become sober because I really got strung out, you know, with the alcohol abuse. Some of the others, you know, a little too much powder in the nose. And I know Prince had struggled after I left with substance abuse. I'm not sure what he was using, but he was able to clean himself up. When I was in the band, Prince was clean. He didn't do anything.
There's a myth and a legend around the song Kiss. Rather than me ask you a long-winded question, I think the leap-off point is, did Maserati write the song Kiss? And can you tell us the story, in brief, the evolution of that song?
It's a simple story. Here it goes for the record. Because, you know, there's a lot of stories out there. He gave me a cassette tape with an acoustic guitar on it, and he was singing. He almost sounded like Bob Dylan. I mean, it was like, you don't have to be beautiful to undress me. That's how it went. And I was like, dude, what do you want me to do with this? He says, it'll be different. It'll be different for them, you know? They need a song like this. And I said, no, they don't. And so me and him went back and forth with that. And I said, he said, just do it. Just try it. And I said, okay. Because you can't say no to Prince. He's going to keep hounding you. So I said, okay. I took it in the studio. It was me and Dave Rifkin, because he was my engineer at the time. And I said, I can't do nothing with this. I said, I got to funk this up. I got to put some brown stank on it. So I came up with the drums first. You know, I played the cassette and I was like, I said, okay, wait. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. Wait a minute. That feels good. Right. So I laid the drum beat and then I grabbed my bass and I put this rumble, you know, I got my little rumble technique. Bass line went bubba doo butch boo boo bubba doo butch boo boo. And I was like, okay, now we got something popping. Now it started to feel good, right? And then there was this keyboard program on the DX7 that I loved. And it was called the Log Drum. And so, you know, I was like, ding, ding, boom, boom, do, diggity, ding, ding, boom, boom, do, diggity, ding, boom, boom. So it felt good. And so I started putting that in there. And then I called Screamer. He was a guitar player for Maserati. I called him in to lay the acoustic guitar down, the way Prince did it. Dun, dun. And it was so boring, it wrecked the whole groove. It ruined it. So Dave Rifkin had this great idea to keypex it. And it's a keypex is a gated unit that you trigger things off of. So he put the hi-hat part in to the keypex as the trigger, and we filtered the guitar into the keypex. And so the outcome was that was it. That made the song. We were like, this is the bomb. And then the next day, we called the guys in to do some background vocals. Prince walked in, and he heard that, you know, and he was like, Mark, where are you going? I said, about to go on dinner break. Okay, I'm just going to do some work on it. And when you get back, you know, just come see me. He took the whole reel off of the 2-inch reel. He took it and he was in Studio A. And he goes in there and I come back about 3-4 hours later. And he's like, I saw that smirk on his face. And he was like, oh, good. Come to the studio. I want you to hear something. And he said, you ready? Sit down, sit down. And I sat down. I was like, oh, what's going on? He said, you know, it's a good song, but, you know, I think it would be better for us. And I was like, us? What do you mean, us? You ain't never said us before. What are you talking about, us? You know, I was like, oh, so you mean to tell me that you won't put this on Prince and the Revolution and I'm going to get some writing credit? And he said, yeah. He said, you know, I'll take care of you. And I was like, okay, let me hear it. I was like, oh man. And then all of a sudden his voice came in. I was like, oh, that's it. I knew it was a hit. Instant hit. It wouldn't have been a hit on Maserati. It would have been a great song, but it wouldn't have been a hit. It was Prince's sexuality that made that song work. And so I knew it was a hit instantly, and I had to go back and tell the guys we lost the song. And that didn't sit well with them. You know, they really got angry because, I mean, it was banging. I think Questlove, you know, Amir, does the Jimmy Fallon show, the drummer from The Roots. He's a DJ. He has the original version. He plays it all the time, the Maserati version. And so you can hear, you know, it was banging back then. So you can hear that it's pretty much the same song, just a little more rhythmic. But when Prince put his thing on it, it just, you know, we knew we lost it. We weren't getting it back. And that's how Kiss was born.
And now we're going to have the audio to prove it, Mark, forever. That's the good news. Now, listen, I wanted to ask you a question about Prince as a band leader. If you love music and you've watched some of your performances, you mentioned James Brown, you know, one of the all-time greats. You see footage of you playing in the Revolution where Prince will shout out 25 and the band will have to give him 25. I just wondered, James Brown was famous for fining his bands and, you know, docking them money. Was Prince ever sort of mean to you for missing licks, or were you ever fined or anything like that? What were the worst things that he would do as a band leader?
He was beyond mean when it came to that. I mean, I've talked to some of the other band members just to find out how he treated them. And, you know, they all said, you know, they would get fines and stuff, but he would never take the money. He took the money from me. See, when I got fined, he took the money. That's where half of my rumble technique came from. You know, I learned ghost noting. I really learned how to ghost note so that I wouldn't get caught off guard, because sometimes I did not hear him or see, like he would say, you know, jam and B flat. I didn't hear that. All I heard was jam. So I would just start rumbling. It didn't matter what key I was in. I would just start rumbling and nobody know. And then once I would listen, I could hear what key they were in, and then I could fall right in the pocket. But I had to do that to keep from getting fined so much because, you know, I'm the bottom end. And believe me, I make a mistake, he hears it. You know, like sometimes he'll throw up three fingers, which means bet, bet, bet. But from my angle, I only saw two fingers. So, you know, I would hit it twice, and then everybody would hit that third one. But because I was rumbling, he didn't know if I was hitting it or not. So, there, you know, I had to learn ways to keep from getting fined. We were on tour, and we were learning new stuff at soundcheck. And I remember once I lost a week's pay. It was over $1,200 I lost in fines because I just kept messing up. And boom, he was just on a roll that week. And so, yeah, Prince fined you. Don't let anybody tell you different. That joker fined. They, you know, some people's memories don't serve them well. When that money comes out your pocket, my memory's very clear.
I read an interview on Rolling Stone's website with Levi Sisa, who played with Prince in the later years after Your Good Self. And he said in the article that Prince could play exactly like the record and beyond. And if you couldn't do that, then you couldn't get, then you wouldn't get a plane ticket, or you'd have to get a plane ticket home, I should say. Now, when you joined the band, was Prince quite clear early on the sort of standards that he expected? And how difficult was it to match those standards of playing?
I never had that problem with Prince. You know, it's interesting because Levi was on guitar. See, I was supposed to be the bass player and Sheila E. was the drummer. And then, of course, Mika Weaver on guitar too. I turned it down because I was at that point in my career with Prince where I was done. You know, I mean, he had made so many promises that he broke that I, you know, enough was enough for me. And we were still cool with each other, but it's just, you know, I had to depart. I noticed, though, when he put that group together, he, you know, they were a very talented group of musicians, but very controlled by him. They didn't really have the freedom we had in the Revolution. In the Revolution, we were able to create. You know, we became part of the creation of the sound. Sign of the Times was, you know, I'd say almost 50, 60% the Revolution. But you could tell he made that shift back to being a solo artist, where in the Revolution, it was Prince and the Revolution. See, it was a band like Fleetwood Mac or Sly and the Family Stone. So it was a different concept. And because it was a different concept, you know, the attitude was different as far as our ability to play and learn things. If there was a song that we were writing, we all wrote it together. And a lot of people don't understand that. You know, a lot of the stuff from the Revolution days was stuff we all wrote. You know, he just took the credit for it, of course, because he was the boss. And that's just how it ended up in the end. But we all contributed to these recordings. And that's why it sounds the way that it does. Where NPG... it was more, you know, okay, learn this part. And that. So I think that's probably what Levi was talking about. Very, you know, you had to play it the way you received it. He didn't want all of this fancy stuff, fancy licks and things. He didn't care how good you were. He wanted you to just keep it basic, keep it simple. I hope that answered your question.
Join us in part 3. Where Mark talks about going back to a normal life, shares his favourite memories of Prince, and their final conversation. Hit subscribe for future episodes and follow us on Instagram at SJBlee. You can also listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music.